Welcome to City Talks, a monthly podcast looking at the big issues facing UK cities and the latest thinking on urban policy. I'm your host, Andrew Carter, from the think tank Centre for Cities. I hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to this edition of City Talks. My guests today are Dave Innes, Policy and Research Manager at the Joseph Rowntree Foundation, and Paul Swinney, Head of Policy and Research at the Centre for Cities. Our broad area of discussion today is productivity and its implications for living standards, and obviously the many policy questions that arise from this particular issue. Both JRF and the Centre for Cities have done and are doing lots of work around this issue, so it's a chance for us to explore in a bit more detail areas of agreement, maybe some areas of disagreement, and obviously the policy issues that arise from this particular issue. So Paul, you kick us off. Just talk to us a little bit about the nature of the problem and some of the work that we've been doing, and then Dave can give a kind of view on some of the work that the foundation have been leading on as well.
Well, obviously productivity is the big issue in the UK at the moment. I think we've been grappling with this for a number of years, seeing that productivity is lower than what it is elsewhere across sort of developed or Western Europe, certainly. And it's been quite interesting, I think, over the last sort of year and a half, 2 years, that we've seen a lot of interest all of a sudden in this idea of the long tail. And it's this idea that actually the reason why productivity in the UK is so low is because of this rump of very unproductive businesses that is pulling down UK productivity. And if only we could make those businesses a little bit more productive, actually would then solve the productivity problem. It's been identified particularly by Andy Haldane at the Bank of England, but the OECD have done work on it. It's inspired the government's business productivity review, which we're expecting to see in the coming weeks as well. You know, understanding what are the problems faced by these businesses. So our work around this, I think, has been inspired by seeing this. And I think when I saw Andy Haldane talk about this first off, thought, well, that's actually quite interesting, but I'm not hugely surprised that we do see this long tail, these large number of unproductive businesses. And I think sort of our key insight on that is to do with the our key insight is that we shouldn't expect all businesses to be as productive as each other. You know, the very function, the very nature of them means that actually some of those tasks are very, very different. And so what we do is say, well, actually, well, let's split these businesses into two. We've got sort of one group, which we would describe as local service businesses, and they're very much businesses that sell their local market. So it's your corner shop, it's your hairdressers, it's your fitness instructor, it's companies like that. And then we've got a second group, which are your exporting businesses. So they're not just selling to their local market, they're selling beyond that, to regional, national, international markets. Now what's interesting, I think when you split those businesses into two, what you see is that the long tail is very much dominated by these local services businesses. You know, these businesses tend to be lower productivity, but crucially, I think within this, not only the technical low productivity, but actually the functions that they do means that their scope for seeing productivity improvements is fairly limited. And I don't think we should necessarily be expecting them to see large improvements. So, you know, to visualise that, if we were to say, think about an exercise instructor, for example, you know, the nature of their job today is very similar to what it was at the end of the late 80s, and they're still teaching a room full of people. Now, it might be that they're using their smartphone now to sort of play the music rather than a ghetto blaster as they might have done 30 years ago, but actually it's quite difficult to see productivity improvements there because they're teaching that room full of people. Whereas exporting businesses, on the other hand, tend to be able to absorb innovations. They are open to global competition, which probably drives them on as well. You know, they're constantly trying to find new ways of doing things, and indeed, actually, you know, new sort of markets and industries pop up from that. Yeah. It's these types of businesses that drive productivity growth. So from the point of view of the long tail, actually, I think what we need to be thinking about is the performance of our exporting base, our tradable base. That's where the focus needs to be, on an improving performance of that, rather than just sort of saying we need to improve the performance of the bottom tail. So we observe the long tail. It's interesting to see, but actually that first blush look at it probably doesn't tell us perhaps quite as much about the UK's productivity problem as perhaps we would have hoped from that first cut.
Okay, so that's a good kind of opening salvo in some of the work. So Dave, just give us a sense as to the work that and the perspective, I suppose, that the JRF brings to this questions around productivity, because in part you're thinking about it as sort of in-work poverty, which you talked about, you know, questions more broadly, and if I'm right, you've been doing quite a bit of work looking at international comparisons about how
that productivity issue that Paul's outlined, how we compare to other places. Just walk us through that sort of stuff, and then we can get into these kind of questions about long tail and all of those sorts of things, and get your perspective on that as well.
Yeah, sure. So I think the first thing I wanted to say is that I agree with Paul, a lot of points Paul has made in a lot of ways. So on the importance of tradable sectors to local growth, you know, there's a fair bit of evidence out there that this is how growth of local areas kind of takes place over time. That said, I guess the points I want to make are to do with that you can agree with that, but still think it's a bit too quick then to just dismiss the long tail as this kind of important feature. And I guess that's for a few reasons. So the first is that I think it's a bit of a wrong characterization to just think of firms in these sectors as, you know, your hairdressers and fitness instructors or those sorts of examples that Paul mentioned. So our work focuses on low wage sectors in particular.
Yeah.
So that's a subset of the service industries as a whole that Paul's talking about. But even within those, so the biggest sectors of these are retail, hospitality, and administrative and support services.
Yeah.
This sector as a whole, you know, includes some of our biggest retailers, some of our biggest hotel chains, some of our biggest care providers. And then the administrative and support service sector, which in itself is a really big sector, actually. That includes things like cleaning services, security. So, you know, there's a huge number of different job roles in these sectors, huge different types of firms working. So I think it's a bit quick to kind of just pick on a few of those examples and say, well, it's hard to see how productivity can improve over time. But the second point is that, so the work that we've done on international comparisons, as you mentioned about these sectors, show that productivity improvements in these sectors is possible.
Right.
And so the work we've done, it was a piece of work we carried out by researchers at the National Institute for Economic and Social Research, and they compared productivity differences between the UK and countries that we normally see as our competitors, so France, Germany, the US and other European OECD countries. And it looked at the role of those low-wage sectors that I've mentioned in the UK's overall productivity gap with those. So that's often called the UK's productivity problem.
Yeah.
And I guess the main finding was that the UK's productivity problem exists across all sectors of the economy. So there's a bit of a problem So there is a problem within the kind of high-end tech, the sort of sectors that Paul was talking about, but there's also a problem within those low-wage sectors. And so it kind of shows that productivity in our competitors in the US, France and Germany is kind of 20 to 30% higher than it is in the UK. And kind of as you'd expect from their overall size, increasing productivity in the UK's low-wage sectors to the level in those countries could close about a fifth to a quarter of our productivity gap with them.
Yeah.
So, you know, these could make a big kind of contribution to that. The last point I kind of wanted to make about the importance of these sectors is just, you know, picking up on that point about in-work poverty and living standards.
Yeah.
And the government's made quite a big point in their industrial strategy that they're rolling out about saying this isn't just about boosting productivity, this is their plan to boost earning power in the UK.
Yeah.
And this is their plan to, you know, to address the living standards problems that we and others are talking about. And if you want to address those, you really have to care about productivity and the nature of work in these sectors. So retail and hospitality in particular have a huge incidence of low pay, so about three-fifths of workers in hospitality are on low pay, nearly half in retail, and between those two sectors they account for about a third of people in work poverty themselves. The point we'll probably go on to, so I think there's an issue of, you know, if you rely on export growth, how much that's going to flow over, spillovers into those sectors. But I think what it does show is, you know, if you want to bring about that boost to living standards, you really need to care about what happens in
these
sectors.
And so we'll come on to this, we'll come back and get Paul's reflections on that in a second. But so just say a little bit more, Dave, about the relationship between productivity growth within a sector or within firms, and then the degree to which, if we do observe productivity growth, that translates into wages, which is ultimately, you know, what you're kind of interested in, which is terms and conditions of labour and all the rest of it. What's the relationship around that from that work and from the other work that you've been doing?
Absolutely. So this is another issue we've spent quite a bit of time looking at, and I think the overall message is that, you know, there's a note of caution here really for the government's aim of boosting productivity to drive up wages. So I guess what we know at the national level is there's a pretty close link between productivity and wages.
Yeah.
So over time, wages tend to go up when productivity does. The kind of stagnant productivity for the last 10 years is probably the main explanation for stagnant wage growth. But what we were interested in is the same true at the sector or firm level?
Yeah.
So we funded a bit of work by some researchers at the University of Sussex, where they merged business data with employee data to kind of look at what happens when firm productivity increases. Is that passed on to wages?
Yeah.
And the results, it's fair to say, were not particularly encouraging. So it did show there is a relationship.
Yeah.
One interesting point is that it's slightly stronger at the sector level than the firm level, which kind of makes sense if you think that if you increase productivity in one firm, maybe the firm can capture that. If you increase it across the sector, maybe that person has the opportunity to move to another
yeah.
firm to kind of increase their wages. But all of these effects were pretty small. Now, in terms of interpreting this, there's a kind of bit of caution about the research, because this was studying changes over the last 10 years, which isn't exactly a normal period
no.
for either productivity growth or wages. So some other studies in other countries and other time periods have kind of shown a bit of a stronger effect. But I think the overall message is that there's kind of no guarantee that there's going to be this kind of automatic pass through at the firm or sector level from
yeah.
productivity to wages. I guess the message that you know, that we want to send to government on that is you need to care about how you're improving productivity then. So you need to make sure that the ways you're doing that are the ways that are most likely to benefit.
Yeah, it's a kind of interesting one there, because I mean, get your thought on this as well, because I suppose people here, we talk about this quite a lot, but there's a kind of rates and levels question in there, which I think that, you know, it's a fairly observable relationship where higher productivity firms typically pay higher wages. That's a kind of observable, which I think we would broadly agree with. But that's different from if you improve productivity from whatever base, the degree to which who captures or who benefits from going from one to the next, which is the kind of rate question and level move, which I think is yeah. kind of interesting.
Absolutely. So, so there's a wider literature. So I guess what's important for policy perspective is you know, the effect on an individual. So it's trying to
yeah.
tease out the
yeah.
bit that. So obviously you'd expect high skilled individuals to go to work for more productive firms, and that kind of shows up in their pay as well. There's kind of two ways that people have tried to look at, well, what's the impact on an individual of either moving to a more productive firm or from increases in that firm productivity that they kind of continue working in. And I think across the board, they found slightly bigger effects than we have
yeah.
on wages,
yeah.
but still not all of those
not
benefits
okay.
are passed on to
yeah.
workers.
So Paul, so just pick up on from you know Dave's point of view. I mean, in a sense, I think it's not that you did say, but in a sense, you know, it's not that we don't observe the long, we do observe a long tail, and we know that there are loads of people that work in it. I think that the interesting question becomes, notwithstanding the characterization questions, but really how likely or possible do we think we can get some improvements in you know, in productivity in those type of firms? So, because we looked at some of those sort of questions,
yeah.
and then we'll get,
yeah.
obviously keen to pick up a geography question, which is obviously one of the things that we're particularly interested in, and maybe you can come back on the international experience, but how we, you know, where we saw improvement, where was that coming from?
Yeah. Well, I think it's the element of low wage sectors don't necessarily equal local services and
mm-hmm.
don't necessarily equal exporters as well.
Yeah.
And I think it's the sort of low wage exporters or exporting jobs, you may well see or see great scope for seeing productivity improvements within them. And so I think it's about that element of, you know, the exporting base. How does exporting base perform? And that's about the very highly productive exporters, but it's also about the, you know, the not so productive exporters, and particularly those that where wages aren't particularly great. And what does that then mean from a productivity and wage point of view, an inclusivity point of view? But then there's the element, I think, of sort of the local services jobs, of which many of them are on the long tail, and we do tend to see quite low wages within them. Actually, it is that element of scope of trying to see productivity improvements within them. Now, I'm sure there are ways of improving productivity. I think if we can, then we should look to do that. But I think the very nature of those jobs makes that much more difficult. So let's say I've sort of used the example of the exercise instructor and a characterisation, and I guess you have to do that. But if you sort of think about a waiter or a waitress, you know, again, their job hasn't really changed over recent decades. They may now, some of them have handheld devices, or interestingly, not all of them. Don't know what that says about actually how that improves their productivity or not. Or say a hairdresser, you know, they're still cutting the same numbers of heads of hair. Today is probably what they were 50 years ago, even with the invention of clippers and things like that. There are definitely ways, I think, to see sort of marginal improvements there. But if we are, if the question that we're trying to answer is, how do we improve the UK's poor productivity relative to other developed countries, shifting or having a focus on sort of the long tail, which is majority made up by low-skilled local services firms, is probably not the way to achieve that. You know, it's very much about much more of the exporting base. Some of that is the sort of the low-skilled element, but actually quite a lot of that will be the high-skilled element too, about them coming up with new innovations and creating new economic opportunities and pushing the economy on. If, however, the question is then about wages and low pay and inclusivity, which is different to productivity, then I think there are lots of things to be thinking about there, and we should definitely be then thinking about the local services industries in particular. But the intervention there might be around, say, increasing living wage and things like that. But that's a different question, I think, to the productivity challenge question. So where, you know, it's not a case of ignore local services, but I think it's a case of what is it that policy is trying to achieve. And the productivity element of that, it's exporters. Actually, the inclusivity element will be very much about the local services businesses, but the intervention will probably look a little bit different there, I think, is how we see it.
Yeah, so they're coming on that, because it's a kind of question. If we're ultimately focused on the income level, you know, incomes for people, you know, working in those sorts of industries, there is a range of measures or policy options available to us, and interventions that boost productivity in some shape or form, you know, the degree to which that plays, so we can talk about that. But also, just come back on that, but also in response, think about that, so the international experience response, and if we have seen improvements, how is that, how have they achieved that?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple of reasons we've got to be slightly careful when we're kind of putting this argument across to not be comparing apples and oranges. Because I know Paul's work has been based on productivity differences between places in the UK.
Yeah.
Our work's been based on productivity differences between the UK and other countries.
Yeah.
There's also this complication that not all the low-wage service sectors are not all local service providers in Paul's sense. So there's kind of a couple of reasons that we need to be a bit careful kind of not to be talking across each other. I think a couple of things that are relevant is to do with international comparisons is that Andy Haldane's work kind of highlighting the importance of the long tail. So the very reason that he wanted to focus on the long tail is that that's where we look different to other countries. So if you plot the distribution of productivity among firms in the UK, compare that to our competitors, there's a similar kind of proportion of firms at the high productivity end, but there's a bigger concentration of firms within the UK at the low productivity end. So I think you kind of, from that point, have to ask, well, why is it that we kind of look different to other countries on that point? So our work doesn't necessarily directly give us the answer to that question, but I think it shows that, you know, whether that's to do with just the exporters at the bottom end, and we can bring those up, or whether it's to do with, it is possible to improve productivity among the local service firms within that bit, it kind of shows that other countries have done things differently. Mm. We can surely learn from that to kind of to bring about improvement in the bottom tail in the UK. So the other thing that we've learned from our international comparison is to do with what explains the difference in productivity between the UK and other countries. So the work I mentioned by Nisa then went on to look at differences. So it's normal to kind of decompose productivity differences into the amount that comes from skills in the labour force, the amount that comes from capital investment, and then the amount that comes from the efficiency that you're using the inputs into production. But in this case, looking at low wage sectors, that's basically the efficiency you're using the skills of your workforce.
Sure.
And it's that efficiency point where the UK seems to look different to its competitors. which kind of suggests to us it's something to do with kind of business organisation in the UK. It's something to do with, you know, making the most of your employees. And the work then went to, on to look at what explains differences in that efficiency across countries.
Yeah.
And it's explained by partly by in-work training. So the UK provides much lower incidence of in-work training than other countries. Partly explained by management quality, which is something that's gained a lot of kind of notice in the literature recently. And also explained by incidence of temporary contracts, which is an interesting one. But we think shows that, you know, if you provide more secure contracting to your workforce, they're more likely to be kind of loyal to the firm, put more effort in, and achieve higher productivity. And that's an area where the UK actually has a lower incidence of temporary contracts in countries like France or Italy, but it's increased since the financial crisis, which is maybe worrying from a productivity perspective. I think those three elements are interesting thinking about the living standards question, because as I kind of mentioned before, we think you need to focus on the kinds of productivity improvements that are going to benefit workers, and those three kind of productivity improvements seem to be the types that would kind of get you in the right direction anyway.
Yeah.
So I think there's a kind of basket of things really that the government should start pushing for low wage sectors in general.
Yeah, I mean, I'll bring Paul in because I think in addition element that we typically, or the centre of the cities typically thinks about and focuses on is, you know, is there a kind of geography, a place element that, you know, can go into that, the mix of what explains the variation. Paul, you know, just say a little bit about that one and kind of come back on some of the things that Dave's been saying.
Yeah, I think the geography point is a really, really interesting element within this, and it's certainly the second insight that we introduced in the paper. Certainly, I think it's a question I've had back a number of times from our work, and we sort of had that, this at the Bank of England recently as well, was, yeah, but actually when you look at the international comparison, exactly as Dave says, actually the long tail isn't quite as long or isn't quite as fat or whatever it is, sort of the term we want to use for it, in other developed countries. And I think that there are two interesting elements from that. I think the first is, it would be really interesting to see the export of the local service breakdown in the other countries. And my hypothesis would be actually the local services businesses, there won't be too much difference between them in terms of the spread, but the exporters will be where there's the greatest spread, probably at the lower end as well as the upper end. And so the second answer we have to that actually plays very much into sort of looking at the geography within the UK. So, you know, if we look at the productivity of the Greater South East, particularly cities within the Greater South East of England, you know, not only are they the most productive parts of the UK economy, but actually they're some of the most productive parts of Europe. And I think we lose that a little bit when we have the excellent stats around, you know, a worker in France or Germany produces in 4 days while a UK worker produces in five. It's like, yes, that is true in aggregate, but actually if you split this down, you know, a worker in the Greater South East is more productive than a French or German worker. So the UK's productivity problem doesn't sit within the Greater South East of England, it actually sits elsewhere. Now, that's quite interesting when you say, well, let's look at the distribution of businesses. Let's look at the long tail and how it plays out across different geographies. And what we see is that when we look at local service businesses, actually the distribution of those businesses in terms of productivity doesn't really vary very much across the country. So, you know, the long tail in every part of the country is dominated by local services businesses, and actually the picture, the distribution of them, those nice sort of kernel density charts they call that we put in our report, you can see actually they don't really vary very much. A hairdresser in Plymouth is as productive as a hairdresser in Blackburn, for example. Where we start to see differences, I think, is in the distribution of exporting firms. And what we tend to see is, particularly in the Great South East, in cities in the Great South East, there's a much lower share of lower productivity exporters and a much higher share of high productivity exporters. And really the difference we see across the country is the performance of the export base across different parts of the country. Now again, if we think about the Great South East as being one of the most productive parts of Europe, and so we then sort of use that as shorthand for, let's say it's Germany instead of the Great South East, and compare it to the rest of the country, this again would suggest that actually what we'd expect to find is that there wouldn't be much difference in terms of local services, but there is a much greater difference in terms of the performance of exporters between the UK, Germany, France, etc. Of course, hopefully we'll get to see the data on that at some point and we'll be able to test that, but certainly even looking within the UK sort of points to the fact that the issue may well be around the performance of the exporters within the UK. as opposed to sort of, you know, the forms of local services in the UK, the local services in places like Germany.
And there seems to be, so, and part of that argument is that there are place factors that help us help us understand the geography of exporters.
Absolutely.
So it's, you know, like Dave highlighted several, you know, management practices, skill levels of the individual, workplace usage or the use of the workforce in not only in delivering or doing, but actually in thinking and innovation. Geography, you know, there are place factors that we would add on to that list in terms of the things that seem to be happening or not happening.
Absolutely, and I think we would, we probably wouldn't just add it on as well. I think we would try and say this is quite fundamental in terms of what's happening.
Yeah.
I think, again, let's say stats around, say, UK worker produces in 5 days what a German worker produces in 4 actually very much masks a problem that, you know, a national productivity figure of X thousand pounds per worker, whatever it is, doesn't really mean anything to anybody. There's probably isn't one place in the UK that hits that national average because there's so much variation around it. And I think, you know, this discussion around sort of productivity in the long tail has very much been focused at the national level, but actually the problem looks very different across the country, and the problem doesn't occur within the Great South East, it's occurring elsewhere. So this has to be central, or the geography of it has to be central in terms of how we consider this problem. And so then you say, well, actually, what is the role of place within this? Well, what's really curious is that if you look at, or cities are supposed to be these places where, you know, you concentrate lots of jobs and economic activity in very small places, and by concentrating that all in one place, you get these sort of multiplying benefits of doing that. It's that horrible word agglomeration, which is, you know, concentrate activity in one place and productivity is amplified, it's multiplied by being there. That plays out within cities in the Great South East. You know, they lead the productivity performance of the South East generally, which, as I said before, is one of the most productive places within Europe. And, you know, these cities are very much sort of functioning as they should. If you look elsewhere in the country, actually, we see the opposite. We see cities elsewhere in Britain actually lagging behind, you know, non-urban areas elsewhere in the country. Now, you could say, well, okay, that just means that sort of non-urban areas are performing very well and there's not a problem there. But actually, I think we'll sort of flip that on its head and say, well, these cities should be more productive. You know, by concentrating activity in one place,
yeah,
they should be sort of amplifying the activity that goes on within them, and yet they don't. You know, the UK's productivity problem, you know, isn't just an issue, I think, outside of the Greater South East, but it's particularly an issue about cities outside of the Greater South East and how they're clearly not sort of offering the benefits to high productivity businesses to come in and invest in them in the way that they should be. And that has big implications not only for people who live in those cities themselves, but in terms of those people who live around those cities and might be able to access the job opportunities there. But crucially, from those people who only think about this from a national point of view, it has huge implications for the national problem that we have, because the national problem is very much centered within these cities. And I think until we actually crack that and understand why that's the case and make interventions that very much target that, I think we'll be struggling to really solve the productivity challenges that the nation faces.
Yeah, your kind of thoughts on, you know, on that, and the kind of, I suppose, the, you know, the place element to, you know, to some of the conversation, and then how that plays out when we get into sort of policy, what might we do about these issues?
Yeah, I think I would completely echo Paul's comments really about the importance of place in the UK's overall productivity problem. This is something we highlighted from the start in our response to the government's industrial strategy green paper. I think when you compare kind of productivity across regions in the UK or these city regions or whatever geography you kind of go for, it's incredibly noticeable how different they are across the country compared to other countries. I think the only things I would add on top of what Paul said on this is that, so I had a quick look at the kind of ONS figures on average productivity difference between regions in the UK, and they are still there within low wage sectors, and Paul's right to say they're smaller than within, so the differences are smaller than if you look at professional scientific, you know, sort of high-end exporting sectors. But, you know, productivity in retail in Yorkshire and North East, about 80% of that in London, in the administrative and support service sector, which there's also really important big ones, about 2/3 in Yorkshire, what it is in London. So the differences are there, which kind of, I think, still shows that even regionally, in terms of regional differences, these sectors are really important. I think that there's one other point here about the kind of comparisons between cities in the north and London, which is to do with kind of whether London's the best model to be trying to replicate anyway. And I don't have the figures on productivity, but one thing we know is that London's incredible economic growth has not been accompanied by a fall in poverty here. And there's lots of issues at play, you know. So there's to do with there's still a high incidence of low paid work. There's also the impact of the housing market, which has obviously had a huge impact in London. But when you look regionally within the UK and you take account of housing costs, London still has the highest rate of poverty of any region in the UK. So yeah, there's just this issue of is that the best model for other places to be like
that? Yeah, no, I think that's absolutely right. And that picks up, you know, this point you were making in a slightly different way earlier on, which is, you know, we do think about the focus on, you know, on productivity gains and, you know, productivity growth, but we ought to be really mindful about the degree to which and the ways in which that growth is then shared with individuals in the workforce of that firm, for example, or indeed in that, you know, in that city. In a sense, we see, you know, high levels of productivity growth in some places, but obviously, as you say, you know, disparities and or poverty remains, you know, remains high, and you know, is difficult to grapple with. You know, to highlight at this point, which I think is right, which is, you know, necessary, but, you know, but not sufficient, and particularly if we think these things just magically, you know, resolve themselves. So
yeah,
you know, Paul, what are you going
to? I mean, there are two things to pull out from that actually, which are very interesting. I think there's a lot to learn from cities in the Great South East, and London sort of principally within there. And I think we certainly when we go across the country, there are different attitudes towards London, and I think there's all sorts of sort of issues wrapped up with the negative perception of London elsewhere in the country. And I think the point that we always make is that let's sort of remove this name tag of London from sort of this city that sits within sort of the southeast of England and look at it. And what we see is that on the whole, it's a city that performs really, really well. It does being a city very, very well. Let's draw what the positive lessons are from that, but also learn from the failings of that city too. And we'll sort of take that and say, okay, well, let's do this and let's not do that. So I think what London in particular does very well is it's been able to attract in lots of high-skilled exporting businesses in particular. And that's really driven on its productivity growth in recent years, or recent decades, should I say. And you say, well, why is that? Well, that's because London offers a number of benefits to these businesses. It offers access to lots of workers, which are highly skilled, and offers access to what we call knowledge as well, this network of other knowledge-based businesses that attract these businesses in because they want to get access to that knowledge. And crucially, they'll pay a premium for that. So, you know, all these businesses are clustered within the centre of London, one of the most expensive places to do business in the world, and yet they still come and cluster here because they'll pay the price to get access to that knowledge. That hasn't really played out elsewhere. Actually, a number of cities elsewhere are not offering those benefits in the same way, haven't attracted in these higher productivity exporting businesses, and the result is that their productivity is lower as a result, which then has an impact on wages, etc. But Dave raises a really interesting point, I think, within this, in terms of which, coming up with the second element of this, which I do find very troubling, is that, yes, you know, I've just said that London is just being a city very, very well, but then when you look at then the poverty stats, you see actually poverty is very high. And you say, well, hang on a minute, what's going on here? You've got, you know, a very, very sort of strong performing exporting sector, and yet there are still a lot of people here who are in poverty, and we should be very worried about that. And I think this sort of the thing that I find particularly troubling about this is, you know, if we sort of accept this model of sort of exporters and local services, and that actually productivity growth is going to be driven by exporters in the future, as it appears to have been done over the last 20 or 30 years, and indeed probably longer if we could get the data further back, is that we'd expect to see, I think, the divergence between these two broad sectors actually widen even more. And so then you'll see ever greater wage growth in the high end, but actually in the local service businesses, actually you won't really see much increase in real wage growth, particularly if we see that house prices continue to increase. And so what's going on is, you know, the barman in London gets paid more than the barman in Manchester, because demand is high, costs are high, and actually the pubs have to pay those workers more to get them to come and do that job. But the real wage of that worker doesn't necessarily go up, because what happens is, you know, as wages go up in the exporting sector, that sort of pulls up wages in perhaps the local service sector, so the barman gets paid a little bit more, but actually increases house prices too, because demand has gone up and we're not building enough houses to address that. The implication is actually the real wage, the amount of money really in that person's pocket once they pay their rent, is the less. Yes. It's the same or might have even gone down. And I find that challenging because actually what does that then mean from an inclusivity point of view? Will we continue to see these divergences? And what does that then mean from a policy point of view? And you then get into elements of, well, you live in wage and things like that.
Yeah.
I think it's crucial to try and keep those things separate or understand that there are potentially different goals our policy is trying to achieve from a productivity point of view and an inclusivity point of view. And that just by focusing on poverty doesn't mean you're ignoring inclusivity, but it might mean actually we need a suite of other policies to try and deal with that because we observe this going on. We may not be able to do anything to stop it or might not actually want to do anything to stop it from a national economy point of view, but then we're going to have to have a range of other policies in place because we can't keep having these divides going on at the same time.
Interesting point. I think that's absolutely right. It can turn into, I suppose, some of the policy implications or policy options, you know, for us. You talked a little bit about some of the things that you've been looking at, or you know, through the foundation have been looking at. Start with, or expand a little bit more on, you know, improving practices and then ultimately wages and, you know, hopefully standards a little bit, wages in the kind of long tail or the lower productivity set. I mean, you know, you talked a little bit about management skills, workforce, and, you know, but just can you unpack that a little bit more and talk a little bit about, you know, what policy options are available to us and, you know, do we have a sense that they, you know, if we introduce them, that they kind of work? Because I think the other thing you're rightly focusing on, always alluding to it, is, you know, an increasing incidence of, you know, in work poverty, right? Which is related to, you know, real wage growth or the absence of it, and actually, you know, cost of living increases because of a whole bunch of different things. But go on.
So maybe if I talk about the kind of business productivity question first, and then we can kind of come on to the living standards point. So I guess the implications of the work we've done, as I kind of mentioned earlier, is that there seems to be a problem within firms generally, but about how they're using kind of the quality of the workforce as it exists. So there seems to be this kind of efficiency point within firms. So I guess the policy kind of implication there is not that you need something big external that's going to kind of shift the dial on things, but it's actually to do with influencing what happens within the workplace. Which is quite a complicated policy challenge, I think.
Yeah.
And I mentioned those kind of three areas that we think really should be the big focus: so raising the level of in-work training, improving management practices, and reducing the incidence of temporary contracts. But more broadly, you know, just provide secure and better contracting, I think. But I think we've seen some innovative examples recently that show it is possible to do that. We don't have this kind of fantastic evidence base, so I can point you and say it's improved by 1 point that you did, you know what I mean? But I think we're at the point of seeing kind of interesting things being tried that it's worth just seeing what happens with and kind of evaluating them properly. So the first of those is Be the Business, which has obviously been kind of government initiative spin-off, but it's kind of taken on a life of its own now. They're doing some really interesting work with hospitality firms in Cornwall that has this kind of place-based aspect of saying, and it's kind of quite network-based as well. Trying to learn from best practice from some firms that are doing really well, but then going into other firms saying, okay, well, what services do you need to kind of improve things along that way. A similar sort of initiative, Productivity Through People programme, which brought in people from really high performing firms, like BAE Systems, and took them into really low performing firms. Some of these are in kind of exporting stuff, but they've actually branched out more into the kind of services sectors have been going on. And interestingly, they told us they found kind of very similar challenges across those, which probably hints to the fact that across different sectors, bits of that long tail are actually quite similar and facing similar challenges. And another one that kind of shows what kind of problem we're dealing with was there was a pilot done by CIPD called the People Skills Pilot, which provided really, really kind of basic low-level HR support to some SMEs. In three different places, Hackney, Stoke and Glasgow. And it's the kind of support that kind of feels like, are you sure a kind of business needs this?
Yeah.
But it's kind of quite low level, but it's actually kind of anecdotally, at least within those businesses that had the support, right, it really helped them to kind of organise themselves and kind of improve productivity on the measures that they say they have. I guess an important question for policy is that if these things are good for businesses, why aren't they
doing
it?
It's a podcast, but I'm bristling with that exactly. Why aren't they doing it themselves?
Exactly.
I mean, why should we support them to do it? I mean, they're kind of interesting, right?
Exactly. So just why aren't they? And then I think part of the answer lies in another bit of work that we did, which was more kind of qualitative work with employers in North Midland, actually just happened to be based there, which was more kind of asking them how they think about productivity,
yeah.
how they think about wages, which sometimes tells you really different things to big quantitative work looking at kind of national data sets. But one thing it kind of showed was, among a broad range of firms, this sort of short-termism and doing things a certain way because either that's how they've always done them
yeah.
or that's how their competitors do them. And this idea of, trying to innovate, trying to think about management practices, some of the bigger SMEs, having normal HR practices, just was kind of quite foreign to them because
yeah.
that's not how they kind of practice. So I think taking into account that kind of business myopia really is really important in this policy, and just kind of thinking that actually a lot of these changes won't happen, but that's not because they aren't good for business and for the people. It's just because of the way kind of these businesses tend to function. I was struck by an example in a discussion we had before of how in Germany, I kind of hesitate before every comparison.
Well, you have to compare
everything, but so I think it's in Germany, sort of 97% or 98% of firms across the country are signed up to a local chamber of commerce or of some sort or another, and you've just then got this automatic network for
yeah.
best practice sharing, and it's that sort of thing that I think we just completely lack here. And I don't think it's the government's role then to just come in and say we need
yeah.
to impose this from the top, because that's organically come about over years and years. But it's I think there's a big space for some sort of networking thing that really gets into kind of the way firms practice.
Yeah. That's fantastic. So
yeah.
So what Dave's been saying is around within the firm management practices, where and all the rest of it. Give us the sort of policy perspective response. Particularly if we're focused at the higher end, right, the kind of leaders or potential leaders in terms of the good firms that are either exporting already and or could be exporting, but just the kind of place-based policy options that we should be thinking about, that we should be putting on the table as well.
Yeah, I think the there are a number of firm interventions that I think would be very, very important, but I think there's a wider element here about, well, does that deal with the geography that we
yeah.
see? And I think a lot of the discussion so far in policy circles has been about, from Andy Haldane's point of view, he puts forward, if you only shift sort of the bottom end up a little bit with firm interventions, the business productivity review that the government's doing is very much about firm level interventions. And what being the business is doing as well is that, well, we'll make firm level interventions. I mean, I think there's a philosophical point there that we've touched on already about, well, what is the role of government to actually be going and telling these businesses
yeah.
what to do? And I think the chambers in particular have got a very interesting role here, as Dave says, about being able to share best practice and allow sort of firms to sort of to talk to each other and perhaps support mentoring schemes and things like that. But I think there's a bigger challenge here too that will undermine, I think, or make less effective, I think, some of these firm level interventions that could be made. And I think if we say, think about, say, Hull, which we do a case study in the report on, and sort of look at the distribution of exporting businesses that they have there, what you tend to see is that their big challenge is that they haven't really got very many high-performing exporting businesses. Now, the reason for that is because of the benefits that Hull offers. So if we think, as we were sort of saying earlier, that high-skilled exporters are looking for high-skilled workers and sort of a knowledge network of the high-skilled businesses, Hull doesn't really offer that in the way that we would like it to offer. But it does have a number of offers. It does offer access to workers, but they're lower skilled. And it also offers access to lots of cheap land. And I think that's probably why we then see the types of exporter that we have in Hull, because it's got a tradable base, it's got an exporting base that is quite large, but it's lower skilled. It's because of those benefits that it offers to one type of exporter rather than another type of exporter. So the challenge here, I think, for Hull is that we could go in and we could make a lot of firm-level interventions, and indeed, I think management in particular is one where we could do that, But actually, we still wouldn't really overcome the problem that Hull faces, and that it just hasn't got very many of these higher performing exporting businesses because it doesn't offer those benefits that those businesses are looking for. And so what that means is that, yes, we do firmly have interventions, but also we're going to have to make city-wide interventions or city-region-wide interventions as well if we want these firmly have interventions to have an impact.
And so what would they be, and what sort of cities can we look at, preferably outside of the Great South East, you know, that, and certainly not London, has done them or is in the process of doing them. So what are those kind of city region interventions, and who's doing it or beginning to do it that we could point at?
Yeah, I think the main one is skills. You know, if let's imagine that we're CEOs of foreign companies looking to stick their pins somewhere on the map of the UK, and it's a high skilled operation, you're going to do that in the places where you know you can get the workers that you want to employ. And so if a city doesn't offer that, that's going to really sort of limit its attractiveness for attracting in those types of businesses. But then on top of that, I think what we're increasingly seeing is particularly sort of the service exporting element, and that's an important point too. Exporters aren't just about goods, or about services too, which sometimes politicians fall into that trap of thinking it's only about goods. These service exporters in particular are increasingly looking for a city centre location. And again, this comes down to this knowledge network, this ability for cities to offer face-to-face interactions for people to share ideas and information and come up with new innovations. Mm. And indeed, it's innovation that really drives on productivity in the longer term. So what we need to see, I think, is cities having city centre locations that are attractive places to go and do business, that offer density, offer access to lots of other businesses. And so from a place point of view, it's then asking the question, well, why is our city centre potentially not as attractive as what it could be, and how do we try and turn that round? That's to do again with skills, it's to do with commercial space and offer, it's to do with public realm, transport, and all of these things coming together. In terms of cities that I think have done this to some extent, I think on the skills front, we probably haven't seen as much sort of concerted effort as what we would like to see. And I think that applies across the country, and it should be front and centre of economic policy. And it always seems to be put in the bucket of that's just a little bit too difficult, really. So we'll talk about fast train links, so we'll talk about shiny new buildings or something like that. But I think if we look at Manchester and Birmingham in particular, from a city centre point of view, they very much had a focus explicitly on their city centre, probably from the late 80s in both cases. It's taken a lot of time, I think, to turn that round. Particularly if you go to the centre of both of those cities now, they feel like they're places that work very well. You've got lots of exporting businesses packed into the centre of them, create lots of high-paid jobs, but actually there's then this spillover effect in terms of you then look around at all the bars, cafes, restaurants, and indeed the high street actually doing very well in those places too, because you've got this market and you've got this footfall that generates demand for local services. Of course, there's still an issue about the wage element, mm-hmm. to create jobs, but what impact does it have for wages? And obviously that's something to be thinking about. But I think at least these two have increasingly have got that city centre element right and have been able to attract in some of these high skilled exporters, and I think there's much to learn for other places in terms of what they can be doing to try and improve the performance of their exporting base.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, reflections on that, and particularly one of the common critiques of the approach that Paul sort of laid out is, well, that that's all well and good for the core of the urban core of Manchester or Birmingham or Leeds, that's not a particularly attractive option for Oldham or for Rochdale or for parts of the Black Country. What we're really talking about is exclusionary type activity. Mm. I mean, that's the critique we hear a lot, and we can unpack that on a different day. But I mean, just your reflections and view on that.
Yeah, so I think there's two points I'd like to make on kind of what Paul said. So the first, kind of all that Paul said about skills, just kind of reiterating how important skills are, but picking up on one particular element, which is kind of basic skills
for
the population. Yeah. So we kind of know that there are about 5 million people across the country lack basic numeracy or literacy skills, which is obviously just a huge barrier to getting on in work at all. And particularly if we think, there's lots of talk about the future, next 10, 15 years, a lot of disruption of kind of workplaces, there's lots of kind of talk about need for retraining in different types of job roles.
Yeah.
which just isn't going to be possible unless you've got that basic skill, right? So I think, you know, across the country really, but also, you know, there's differences across the country in kind of ways that you'd expect,
yeah,
that tackling that basic skills problem is going to be really important, along with all the others. In terms of the kind of agglomeration question, I don't think we've got like a specific take on is agglomeration good or bad for people in poverty generally, so I'm not going to go there on that one. But I think kind of what it really shows is that agglomeration is not enough by itself to solve these problems. So I guess that's the more important point here. So, you know, it might be great at bringing economic growth into a city, kind of agree about, you know, the points about dynamism in Manchester and Birmingham. But, you know, cities are going to need to do a lot more as well to tackle the inward poverty problems that they've got.
Give us a thought on that. I mean, you know, as we share that, you know, the concerns and that, you know, these issues that growth is not enough, as it were.
Yeah.
You know, it's necessary. I mean, but it is necessary. I mean, I think, I don't know, you know, I'm deeply worried by, you know, sort of perception from the statements that, you know, growth is bad, and actually we've had too much growth and we don't need.
Yeah,
I think in many respects, you know, I think a lot of that conversation is misplaced. But for certain, the growth is necessary but not sufficient, particularly if we don't do interventions and support and help people access the growth wherever that might be. And, you know, through money. But in work poverty, just give us your view on that. Obviously, that's a, you know, core of what the foundation's all about.
So in many ways, so starting with the national level, so I think you mentioned in work poverty, and I think a lot of people kind of, your first thought is, well, the lever's minimum wage, right?
Yeah.
And so recently we've seen raises in the national living wage,
yeah,
which have been a good thing for people,
yeah,
on low wages. I think just mentioning at the national level, they have not been enough to compensate for the loss of income people.
Yeah.
People in work poverty have had through cuts to the work allowance through universal credit. But that said, they have been a good thing for people on low incomes. So I guess your first thing is, you know, do you want to push that higher? I think we're aware that, you know, so far increases in the minimum wage have been a good thing without having
negative effects, right?
Exactly. So we haven't seen
any
employment effects. That doesn't mean you could keep ratcheting it up and up, and there wouldn't be. And I guess there's also a place dimension to this, because it could have different bite in different places. But you know, so far it's been a good thing, and it's rising over the next few years, and that is good. There's lots of other dimensions to quality of work and how that kind of puts money in people's pocket that we think need to be addressed, as well as kind of overall wage levels. And so you need to look at the number of hours people work as well, and also kind of progression opportunities for people out of those kind of lowest paid jobs. So a bit of work we've been doing about that is, you know, lots of kinds of families have work requirements that mean they need to work part-time, for example.
Yeah.
But part-time workers have much fewer opportunities to progress
instead
of work.
Yeah.
But kind of work, so time-wise, organisations have been leading work with firms to kind of look at what can you create progression opportunities. And it's another case where it kind of seems a win-win to firms, that actually you can get productivity benefits to firms at the same time as kind of benefiting the workers in there as well. And I think that speaks to this kind of broad idea that lots of these elements of good work are good for productivity as well. And that's something that a few cities have been picking up on recently. And I think we're kind of watching that with a keen eye and thinking that this could be something that, you know, can be done at the local level to kind of galvanise things about good work, but also kind of benefit productivity as well. So in Manchester, Andy Lyon has been leading work around creating this good employment charter.
Mm.
We've also seen in London, a similar kind of thing going on, which part of that is about paying the living wage, which obviously recognises that has to be higher in London, but also it's about kind of recognising other aspects of good work that make a difference to people in work poverty as well. I think one thing that's interesting, so in Manchester, the way that's been played out is very much on this idea that good work is good for businesses. So I think their idea is that, you know, they want to, so it's going to be a charter and we'll sort of recognise where firms are doing a good thing, but also be accompanied with some sort of business support services that say, we'll help you do this because it's, and you should want to do this because it's going to be good for your business, but also it's going to bring about this kind of good outcome as well. I think a more challenging aspect of this is kind of thinking about whether places should use the other kind of services they provide to firms leverage those services to bring about good work outcomes, which is a slightly different point. But I know kind of conversations in the cities have been around, well, we put a lot of effort into attracting companies here, but often don't apply kind of constraints on, you know, the type of work they might provide. And if we're providing all those services, should we, you know, add these constraints that the quality of work these businesses are going to be providing should be of a sufficient quality, so should pay the right levels, or should provide kind of progression routes. It could be that it's to do with providing training opportunities for the local population and these things, which we think is a really interesting idea, and in a way needs to be tried out to see what happens.
That's precisely what I was going to say. In a sense, you know, what's an interesting point is it's at the city scale that some of these things, or many of these things, are being trialed and or at least thought about, and particularly if there are issues about communication and coordination of different types of interventions, it's at that kind of scale that we is probably a better scale to try and grapple with and do something with it than certainly the national scale or the hyper local. And you see this in different policy fields where cities, not only, well, probably less so in the UK for a bunch of reasons, but certainly elsewhere, are at the vanguard of trialing out and being able to experiment with different different types of interventions on the supply side, the demand side. I think in my optimistic moments, I hope that I'm confident that we'll get to more of that practice in the UK, because we'll have to for a bunch of other reasons over the decade ahead. But it's kind of interesting, isn't it, I think.
Yeah.
And so just to close, in terms of big agenda items or things that milestones in the future around these kind of questions, particularly I think addressing these questions about in work poverty and make sure that people have reasonable standards of living because they have they're receiving a mix of wage and or tax credits in order to achieve that. How do you see this unfolded over the next period?
Yeah, so I think what we started talking about, in work poverty is a problem of our times, in a sense. So it used to be 20 or 30 years ago that poverty was associated with worthlessness. It was associated with families that couldn't work for whatever reason. Where nowadays more than half of people in poverty are in a working household.
Yeah.
And just shows that the income people are earning just isn't sufficient to meet their needs. So that is the problem of our times. I don't think we have the answer yet, but it's got to be about kind of the quality of work, and it's got to be about improving work for people in these sectors that I've kind of talked about. It's probably going to need innovation at the city level. We think there's loads that can be done there. It's going to need kind of national input as well. I mentioned the issue of tax credits, but you can increase pay to a certain extent, but reducing benefits is going to kind of have a bigger effect because they're so much more targeted at people at the bottom.
Well, exactly, and they do hit slightly different cohorts. Don't they? Minimum wages, and in work tax credits hit slightly different, groups and individuals.
Yeah, I think the other thing I'd say, that there's lots of talk about the way that the labour market is changing, possible changes to come in the next 10-15 years, and I think it's just, it's going to be important for policy and local places to have the ability to react to those changes as they occur, but also to get the fundamentals right for their population, because you're not going to be able to react to those changes unless you kind of fix the basic skills problems first and kind of get the infrastructure in place to help people find work in the market.
Yeah, that's a good point. Or sort of final kind of thoughts from you on the milestones and into the period, the period ahead.
From a productivity point of view.
Well, So I think in this sort of the space that we've been kind of talking, the relationship between productivity and employment, and obviously for us it's the it's the role of urban areas and cities particularly that where they are and where we hope them they will be in the in the coming period.
Yeah, I think for the national policymaker who's thinking about productivity, I think it's understanding that there are sort of two broad types of business, and we might need to treat them differently. Perhaps not expect the same, expect them to sort of achieve the same levels of productivity to help address the productivity challenge, Well, crucially, it's about the geography too. And I think these two elements, different types of business and the geography, really, I think, fundamentally alter how we view the productivity challenge within the UK. You know, what we really want to see is, you know, those places that, those cities that are way behind the national average in terms of productivity, actually try to close some of that gap. And particularly, I think our big places like Manchester and Birmingham, actually being, we need to see them above the national average rather than below the national average, not only for the places themselves, but for the economy as a whole. So really, it's that focus about, well, actually, how can we try and overcome some of those issues? How do you try and make them more productive? How do you try and attract in those more productive businesses? And then making a series of place-based interventions that overcome that. There's then the second issue around, well, what does that mean from inclusivity, etc.? I know it's a really interesting question about agglomeration and poverty, or how cities create jobs for low-skilled workers. And I think that's something that we're keen to be doing more thinking on, I think, in coming months, because there are challenges that arise from there. I think we do need to understand how those dynamics play out, and then crucially, what does that mean from a policy point of view? You know, particularly if we think that that there could be a challenge, and as I said, I'm sort of quite concerned about this, that actually this sort of splitting out or ever sort of changing element of, you know, it's the leading exporters that are driving productivity growth. What does that mean for people at the bottom end of the labour market? Are we going to see divides widen, and what should policy do about that?
Yeah. My guests today have been Dave Innes and Paul Swinney. Gentlemen, thank you very much for being part of City Talks.
Thank you for listening to this episode of City Talks, brought to you by Centre for Cities. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner. You can find us on iTunes and Stitcher by searching Centre for Cities. Please rate, review and subscribe if you liked what you heard. You can also follow the Centre on Twitter at Centre for Cities, or like us on Facebook and LinkedIn for the latest updates on what the Centre is up to. If you have any comments on the episode or suggestions for topics we should cover in the future, we'd love to hear from you. Do tweet us or send an email to info@centreforcities.org. The music was from Palace Fires by Johnny Foreigner, used with permission, and all rights are reserved.